With talks between the EU and the UK continuing through the night, the Irish Times, Irish Daily Mirror and Belfast Telegraph all lead today with the possibility of a Brexit deal being struck before tomorrow's EU summit meeting. The Times and Mirror strike an optimistic tone with the headlines, "Prospects of Brexit deal at summit improve" and "On the brink of a deal." The Telegraph, meanwhile, leads with a quote from DUP leader Arlene Foster, who said last night that gaps remained on a Brexit deal that her party could support. Insurance rip-offs and insurance scams provide two of this morning's other papers with their lead stories today. The Irish Independent leads with the line that the central bank is to launch a probe into the practice of dual pricing, which is when insurers use big data to target clients, often older customers, who are unlikely to challenge their renewal quotes. The Irish Daily Mail, meanwhile, leads with the arrest of three generations of the one family from West Dublin who are alleged to have lodged up to 60 fraudulent insurance claims against councils in Dublin and Kildare. And that story is also carried inside most of today's other papers. The Irish Sun and Herald both lead today with the questioning of two men in relation to the fatal stabbing of 31-year-old Derek Redden in Loughlinstown in Dublin in the early hours of yesterday morning. Charity in need of €34 million extra per year. That's the lead headline in today's Irish Examiner. The charity in question is the Cope Foundation, which provides services and supports for children and adults with intellectual disabilities and autism. Chief Executive Sean Abbott says that without that extra funding, the charity won't be able to meet its obligation to service users. The Irish News leads today with the line that families of the 10 Protestant workmen who were murdered at Kingsmill in South Armagh in 1976, along with the sole survivor, Alan Black, have called for the inquest into the IRA atrocity, which has been running for more than 5 years, to be brought to an end. The families state that in the past year, a number of hearings have been cancelled or rescheduled. The Irish Daily Star leads today with the Garda investigation into a rape allegation. The Echo, meanwhile, leads with the line that Gardaí say that there has been an increase in pornography investigations in Cork City in recent years. Homeowners are being warned that perpetrators are parking outside homes where there is no Wi-Fi security code to download pornographic images. The Independent runs with the front page picture of Amy Dunn, the woman who, as a teenager, became known as Miss D during her High Court fight to travel for an abortion 12 years ago. She talks to Tanya Sweeney in today's paper about the impact that case had on her life. The picture in the front of today's Times, meanwhile, taken yesterday by Tom Honan, is of two rutting stags in the Phoenix Park. And finally, the Examiner runs with another wildlife picture in its front page today. The picture, called The Moment, which won the Natural History Museum of London's Wildlife Photographer of the Year competition, was taken in China and features a marmot being startled by an approaching fox. A number of other papers also carry the same picture on their inside pages today. And the Mail informs us that, sadly, it didn't end well for the marmot.
Are UK and EU negotiators close to reaching agreement that could see a Brexit in 15 days that doesn't require border checks on this island? Will any agreement pass through the House of Commons? Will the people or the politicians of the North be asked to decide? Talks continued into the early hours in Brussels and will resume shortly. In London, the British Prime Minister met late with the DUP leader and deputy leader, and in Belfast, their Northern Secretary met with the Foreign Minister here. The main stumbling blocks continued to be how to manage customs on the island of Ireland and what role Stormont might have in endorsing any new agreement. Speaking to RTE News last night, DUP leader Arlene Foster said her party still wants a deal and dismissed speculation about a Northern Ireland-only backstop.
We do want to get a deal, but it has to be a deal that respects the constitutional and economic place of Northern Ireland within the United Kingdom. And if there is to be consent, there has to be consent which is in accordance with the Belfast Agreement. In other words, there has to be consent from the nationalist community and the unionist community. And when I hear talk of a Northern Ireland backstop, as I did in your headlines, I think that things are very far off the mark in terms of all of that.
Arlene Foster speaking to the 6-1 News last night. Our Northern editor Tommy Gorman is in Belfast. Our Europe editor Tony Connolly is in Brussels. Tony, to you first, and good morning to you.
Good morning, Gavin.
Where are we this morning?
Well, the talks resume, Gavin, this morning. They carried on beyond midnight last night, and then negotiators took a break and they're back in the room this morning. Now, they have an effective deadline of say around 11 o'clock local time, because Michel Barnier is due to brief the 27 EU commissioners. They have a weekly meeting on a Wednesday, and then he's due to brief member states at 2 o'clock local time. So if there is going to be a deal, it will have to be done in time for those briefings, because the EU is insisting adamantly that there can't be any negotiation at the summit. These talks can't drift in to the summit tomorrow. In other words, leaders will not be going through a text and changing paragraphs here and there. This has to be pre-cooked. It has to be ready for leaders to give their endorsement. So we're not over the line yet. And I understand that there are still a number of key problems, customs being the big issue, but I'm also hearing that VAT is proving to be a bit of a sticky problem. In other words, would Northern Ireland be in the EU's VAT area or in the UK's VAT area? The consent issue as well apparently is causing still some problems. So I think the negotiators still have quite a bit of work to do, but the sense of optimism, I suppose, that evolved during the day yesterday is still there.
Is any deal likely to be a redrafting of the original Northern Ireland only backstop, a case of I can't believe it's not a backstop?
Well, going into this process, the UK tabled their big solution for the Irish question, and that was essentially a dual customs arrangement. So Northern Ireland would be in the UK's customs territory, but to all intents and purposes, it would be operating under EU customs tariffs and rules and procedures. Now, when negotiators started to look in detail about how that would work, they had grave concerns about how you trace goods going from Great Britain to Northern Ireland. Do they end up where they're supposed to end up? Would traders get a rebate for if there's a differential between the EU tariff and the UK tariff? And how would that rebate system happen? How do you cope with fraud and so on? So the EU's position, their baseline position was, look, the Northern Ireland only backstop, the original backstop, is a much simpler, much more legally unambiguous arrangement. Northern Ireland simply stays in the EU's customs territory and applies EU customs rules. And then, of course, you would have to have customs checks along the Irish Sea. So what they seem to be doing is trying to perhaps merge those two positions with fixes here and there. And I think the way to look at this is, from the very outset of these negotiations, the EU has always been determined that any agreement is legally watertight, it's legally operable in the jargon. And whereas the UK's preference has been to have a commitment in principle and then to sort out the legal stuff and the technical stuff afterwards during a transition period. So the way to look at this, I think, is that the more that is nailed down as legally operable means the UK is making more concessions, whereas the more that is left open, then that's a win for the UK. But I think you can guess that the EU, because of its nature, because it's 27 countries, is going to be more insistent on having everything nailed down legally. If things are left open as a commitment to the future and they say, well, we'll try and fix this in this particular way and agreement isn't reached in the future, then the default could be that EU rules will take over. So that, I think, is where the they're trying to work out this particular bridging of the gap.
Tommy Gorman in Belfast, good morning.
Morning, Gavin.
That clip we heard from Arlene Foster when she was speaking to Sharon Tobin last night, she said that suggestions of a comparison with the Northern Ireland only backstop were very wide of the mark. Later that evening, she met with Boris Johnson, herself and Nigel Dodds, and the Financial Times is reporting that they were haggling over a big cash payment. What for?
Well, this is entirely predictable in terms of the DUP. They're giving ground. They already made concessions in relation to regulatory alignment. So in those circumstances where some of their critics will say, you moved, they're going to look for, well, look at what we got. So they're examining the positions, what might be available if, and it's still very much if. So the if would include a significant cash injection to cover for the infrastructure gaps that have developed in the last 3 years, Remember a special deal that they got in relation to welfare reform for Northern Ireland. That's due to run out as well. So in the circumstances, if the DUP were to move, they would demand, and I'm sure they would get, financial compensation that would allow them to say to their support base and beyond, this is what we got for holding out. It's typical DUP. They're very, very hard negotiators. And if you look at what they did last night, they went in, Nigel Dodds, Arlene Foster, and the party's chief executive, Timmy Johnson. They saw Boris Johnson for 90 minutes. They'd have been aware of people like Ian Duncan-Smith and Owen Paterson saying, no, there's too much being demanded there. That will make them kind of nervous. But afterwards, they go quiet. They put nobody up for the radio programmes on the BBCs, on the RTEs this morning, on the Skies. They stay quiet. They let things develop and they see what emerges after people have had a night's sleep in Brussels, after they get back to the table this morning, to see if any further tweaking can be done on that deal.
Tony was talking about the issue of consent and the role that Stormont might play. If Stormont isn't reconvened by Monday, abortion will be decriminalised and provisions to apply from next April will need to be set out by the Northern Secretary. The prospect of, after over 1,000 days, that the DUP and Sinn Féin will in the next 5 days agree to go back into power, is that fanciful?
Well, let's just deal with your question in two parts. First of all, in relation to what Arlene Foster said about a majority of nationalists, majority of unionists, she has been using for a number of weeks now another word, collegiality. And that's Arlene Foster saying, if we did get Stormont up and running, I would expect that the kind of petition of concern mentality that existed in past administrations, we look after our crowd, you look after yours, that she would be willing to have some change there. And I think that's where there's the space on the consent question. Now, in relation to abortion and that October the 21st deadline, so interesting that Simon Coveney, after a busy day in Luxembourg, that he comes back to Ireland. And what does he do? Last night he meets Julian Smith, the Northern Secretary. Now, my understanding is that at 8:15 this morning, the Taoiseach is due to see Sinn Féin, and that Julian Smith, I think, is seeing them at 11:30 this morning. So the Taoiseach and the Secretary of State for Northern Ireland are trying to advance their end. They're trying to see if, against the odds, something can be done to get people back to Stormont by Monday. It's an outside chance, but there's a very real deadline of that decriminalisation of abortion. And there's considerable pressure on the parties to act in relation to that from a lot of support bases around the place. So as long as there's that possibility, you'd expect Simon Coveney and Julian Smith to try and push that side of the argument, because they see how that could become an important, say, element of the overall jigsaw. Also think as well, you have to take account of what's happening in the wider world. Leo Varadkar created this space by the gamble he took last week. Look at what has happened to the pound in recent days. It's at a 5-month high. It's up 5%. So while that optimism is there, you can see why the likes of Julian Smith and Simon Coveney are trying to push things further on.
Tony, finally, back to you in Brussels. What role are you hearing that Stormont might play in any agreement?
Well, the original proposal by the UK was that Stormont would have to give an endorsement to endorse going into this new arrangement, this new modified backstop, 6 months before the end of the transition and then every 4 years afterwards. Now, that proposal seems to have gone. And the question then is, you know, what kind of consent mechanism could you get? Would it be a one-off event? Would it be a referendum, for example, although Arlene Foster has ruled that out? Would it be more like oversight rather than consent? Could you get the North, South and East-West apparatus of the Good Friday Agreement to take a bigger role in this? These are the issues. And of course, because Stormont isn't sitting, and perhaps in the future it might collapse again. So there are a lot of question marks over how this would actually work. And also for the EU, they would feel it's not really for us, the European Union, to tell Northern Ireland how to run its business or to endorse or give the green light to something. This is for the UK government to work out. So all these issues have to be resolved.
Tony Connolly in Brussels, Tommy Gorman in Belfast, thank you. 23:07.
The United States is calling on Turkey to declare an immediate ceasefire in Syria, where its forces are continuing a deadly offensive against the Kurdish population. The Americans, having pulled their troops out of the region, clearing the way for the Turkish invasion, have now imposed sanctions on Turkey. Russia, too, is threatening to intervene alongside its Syrian allies. Meanwhile, the medical charity Médecins Sans Frontières has confirmed that most of its aid activities in northeast Syria have been suspended. MSF's emergency manager for Syria is Robert Onus. He told our reporter Tommy Meskell why it's become so difficult to operate in the region.
Because there are so many different groups fighting in this conflict, it's very difficult for us to be able to negotiate access and negotiate safety for the humanitarian organizations and for our teams. And so without those assurances, it's impossible for us to operate.
What sorts of work were MSF doing in the area? What sorts of humanitarian assistance were you providing?
Our teams were supporting hospitals. We were working in displacement camps. There's already over 100,000 people displaced inside the northeast of Syria before this conflict began. And that's now on top of all those who have been displaced in the last week. So we were responding to existing displacement in the camps, but also to the new displacement that was coming into the towns and villages across the region. If you take one example of that, the water supply system in Hasaka was damaged, and so there was very limited water to the city and the surrounding villages, and these were the areas into which people were fleeing. So they were fleeing the conflict, but fleeing into an area where they had very little capacity to feed themselves and to house themselves, and also there was no water available.
You're leaving now at a time when MSF and charities like yours are needed now more than ever.
Absolutely. It's a very sad instance for us to have to remove our teams in this moment, when clearly the humanitarian needs are increasing, and it's very concerning for us to know that our organization has been forced to relocate its staff, when we know that the existing situation northeast was bad, and it's only going to get worse, and the ability for organizations to respond to that is dramatically reduced.
And that's Robert Onus of Médecins Sans Frontières speaking there to Tommy Meskell. We can talk now to Barzu Daragahi, international correspondent for the Independent UK. A very good morning to you, Barzu, and thanks very much for taking our call. Before we talk about the what is a very complicated and difficult and dangerous situation in northern Syria, what about the picture painted there by Robert Onus? How typical is that of what's happening on the ground in terms of the hundreds of thousands of civilians caught up in this?
Right. I mean, I think that it is, the situation in northeast Syria was pretty grim before this conflict began, and now it's getting worse. But I should add that the situation in the northwest of Syria, in Idlib province, is even more horrific, and it has been going on for months and months and months. And, you know, the international community didn't really pay attention to it. So I think that, you know, it's Syria is a compound, complex tragedy, a disaster for all sorts.
Sorry, I think we've lost Borzu there, have we?
Sorry, I'm right here.
Oh, yes, you're right there. So this, I suppose, is a focus now on what's happening in this particular part of the border area. The aim here of the Turks was to create a buffer zone, Borzu. Is that being achieved? Are they making progress in that objective?
I think it's hard to tell. They say, hold on one second.
Okay. You got a difficulty there. Let's see if we can maintain contact.
They say that they have made some progress, but there's absolutely no clear sign that they have made progress on this plan for this buffer zone. The situation on the ground is very murky. There's contradictory claims by different armed groups. It's a very complex terrain. And the entrance of the Syrian regime, this whole deal between the Syrian regime and the Kurdish-led forces that run the northeast of Syria, adds a further complication to the whole plan.
And what about this suggestion or threat or indication of Russian involvement? Russia, of course, is an ally of the Syrian regime. What role might they play, or are they playing?
I think that the Russians are trying to figure that out themselves. The Russians view the Syrian state as a client, but they are also very much valuing Turkey right now, and they see an opportunity to seduce Turkey out of the NATO alliance. And so that's not something to discount either. I don't think that the Russian government wants to get on the bad side of Bashar al-Assad, but it pretty much controls Bashar al-Assad. On the other hand, Turkey is a prize that it can obtain if it plays its cards right. That is the calculation of Vladimir Putin.
And is it at all clear what the Americans are at? President Trump pulled out the troops. That, in a sense, gave the green light for this Turkish invasion. Now the U.S. is imposing sanctions on Turkey.
I mean, for the U.S., the way to understand it is it's all about domestic calculations. Donald Trump is trying to hold together various conservative constituencies. So he, pulled out of Syria to satisfy one hardcore right-wing constituency in the U.S., and then he imposed sanctions on Turkey to satisfy the neoconservatives in Washington and keep those people kind of in the camp. He has a very narrow coalition. He has very little margin of error in terms of the upcoming presidential elections. That's what it's all about, and there's no other consideration for him.
All right, we'll leave it there. Borzu Daragahi from The Independent, thank you very much for that.
7.32, Brian Finn is here with the Business News. Morning, Brian.
Thanks, Gavin. Good morning. The pound is sitting at a five-month high this morning as traders anticipate developments on a possible Brexit deal. Sterling traders are highly reactive to leaks and rumours at the moment. Any perceived negative news is likely to drive the currency lower again. The International Monetary Fund has warned that growth in the global economy this year will fall to its slowest pace since the financial crisis. It blames the US and China and their trade war. Global output next year, it says, will be almost a full percent behind where it otherwise could have been. It also believes the big four economies, the US, China, the Eurozone and Japan, will see no improvement in their growth rates in the next 5 years. Retailer Penneys, which trades as Primark overseas, is warning consumers not to buy its goods from third parties online, as they'll end up paying more than in-store. Reports emerged in recent days that Penneys was selling its goods through Amazon, but it said it doesn't have a commercial relationship with the online retailer. Currencies, the euro is trading at $1.105 and 86.5 pence sterling.
John Murray, I wonder, did negotiators in Brussels take a break from talking Brexit to watch Ireland and Switzerland, or would they rather stick with Brexit?
Well, perhaps that would be the case. Gavin, you were asking earlier, why can't Premier League players pass the ball to each other?
They do it every week.
Yeah, yeah. Anyway, defeat, of course, for the Republic of Ireland in Geneva last night in their Group D Euro qualifier, Switzerland worthy 2-0 winners. It means we have to beat Denmark at the Aviva on November 18th to qualify for the finals. Seferovic put the Swiss ahead after 16 minutes, and Shane Duffy's own goal in added time sealed the home side's 2-0 win. Darren Randolph had kept Ireland in it by saving Rodriguez's spot kick on 75 minutes, Seamus Coleman handling the ball in the penalty area and being sent off for picking up his second yellow on the night. He now misses the final qualifier against Denmark. Manager Mick McCarthy spoke to Tony O'Donoghue afterwards.
Well, we were beaten by the better team, considerably better team actually, certainly in the first half when we didn't play particularly well, and whatever system we're playing, it doesn't excuse some of our wayward passing and some of the stuff that we did. I changed it midway through, and that settled it down a bit. In the second half, we played far, far better. I think it was a performance we can be proud of. I was certainly the players, and down to 10 men. Second half, not the first half, the second half, and with 10 men, they had a right go.
Is there a lack of confidence in the group in terms of when they're on the ball and to try to throw those passes, to try to make things happen?
Not at all. All the sessions are, all training sessions are that way. They're all, the box is very tight, very technical, that we've got good players. We're playing against a different opposition, of course. They're a big, powerful, strong side as well. They stopped us. I think it showed in the second half that we're capable of doing it.
The change of shape, change of formation. You had three lads at the back and the wing backs. Do you think it worked?
It didn't cause us not to pass the ball to each other, that's for sure. I'm not said to the lads, if in changing it that's the root cause of it, I'll accept responsibility for that. But I'm not accepting responsibility for our inability to pass it to each other in the first half, because we were really poor. Although changing the shape did settle it down. And we had, a better performance in the second half.
Well, this was centre-half John Egan's assessment of the game.
Yeah, obviously very disappointing to lose the game. We know what's required now. We've a massive last game against Denmark, and you know, we know we need to win, and that's what we're going to do.
How difficult was it out there?
I think first half we killed ourselves really. You know, we didn't show enough probably quality and bravery on the ball. But you know, we showed second half when we actually took a touch and played that we can play. And you know, it's just a pity we didn't start like that. We probably waited till we went 1-0 down to play, which is probably the feeling now. It's a bit disappointing that we didn't start from the first minute from that. But you know, we showed out there, you know, that we can play when we get our foot in it. And you know, I suppose that's the only positive we can take, really.
I mean, you played the centre half, three centre halves, wing back situation before. Is it something we need to work a bit longer on?
I don't think it's about the system or anything. I think it's just on the ball. You know, we were just guilty of, you know, maybe forcing things early on, myself a couple of times. And you know, I think as soon as they scored, then we just seemed to put our foot in it and play. And I think especially second half, first 20-25 minutes, you know, we really had a good rattle off and playing good football. And yeah, it's just disappointing that we didn't start like that ourselves.
In the other Group D game, Georgia beat Gibraltar 3-2. Elsewhere, Spain qualified from Group F thanks to a 1-1 draw with Sweden and Stockholm. David De Gea went off with an apparent hamstring injury, making him a doubt for Sunday's Premier League clash with Liverpool. The Ireland under-21s tasted defeat for the first time in their European qualifiers when they lost to Iceland in Reykjavik. Ireland's Leo Connor was sent off as they were beaten 1-0, but Stephen Kenny's side remained top of Group 1, albeit having played more games than their rivals. Tonight, Piemont take on Shelburne in the second of the Women's FAI Cup semi-finals. The winners play Wexford on November 3rd. In snooker news, Mark Allen has won his first round match at the English Open. Allen overcame James Watena by 4-2 in Crawley. Meanwhile, Jordan Brown lost 4-1 at the hands of Louis Heathcote, while Ken Doherty also crashed out on a 4-0 scoreline against Marco Fu, but Fergal O'Brien beat Nigel Bond 4-0. In boxing, Carl Frampton is set to have his first fight in 11 months when he steps into the ring on the 30th of November. The former world champion has recovered from a hand injury and will take on Tyler McCreary in a super featherweight contest in Las Vegas. In cricket, Ireland were edged out by Scotland by one run in their T20 World Cup qualifier warm-up game in Abu Dhabi. The Scots made 210 from their 20 overs, and in response, Ireland, with 70 from Andrew Balburnie, ended on 209 for 9. In horse racing, Enable will stay in training next season. The 5-year-old came up short in her bid for an historic third Prix de l'Arc de Triomphe earlier this month, but owner Khalid Abdullah has announced she will race on next year. There's racing today at Punchestown. The first is off at 2:05, and there's more sport on the RTE News Now app and RTE.ie.
How to tackle online harassment and harmful communications will be discussed at an Oireachtas committee later today. Legal experts will appear before the Joint Committee on Justice and Equality, and among those experts is cyber psychologist Dr. Mary Aiken. The attention economy, in her view, has allowed extreme harmful content to thrive in the online world as clever algorithms promote such material, and children often fall victim while online companies make money. Mary Aiken, good morning.
Good morning.
This is the third meeting of the committee which seeks to hear what opinions, or what options rather, are available for reforming our laws to protect internet users from online abuse and bullying. And you believe it's not as complicated as we might think.
I think the point is that we actually have to broaden the scope of the inquiry. I mean, this morning we're going to be talking specifically about harassment, harmful communications and related offences. But my point to the committee this morning is that they need to, in order to consider this properly, they're going to need to broaden the scope of their inquiry. So let me give you an example. The UK approach, and I've worked closely with the DCMS, which is the relevant department there, which is why I would reference that approach, does not focus exclusively on fragmented aspects of harm. Rather, they're considering a broad range of harms simultaneously. Online anonymous abuse, harassment, cyberbullying, violence online, underage sharing of images such as sexting, self-harm and suicide. So they're looking at this whole broad range of harms. And I suppose the point being that is connectivity. All these things are connected. So there's a relationship between cyberbullying, self-esteem and self-harm. There's a relationship between sexted images, harassment, and then online coercion and extortion. And there is a relationship between harmful content, such as adult pornography, on children's smartphones and then sexual assault committed by children on children.
In response, the Department of Communication has pointed out to us that Minister Richard Bruton has announced that he will bring a heads of bill to government before the end of this year, which will outline the key measures to be included in the bill. These measures will mean, for the first time, setting a clear expectation for online platforms to take reasonable steps to ensure the safety of the users of their service, including in relation to cyberbullying or material designed to promote suicide or self-harm. Do you think that his proposed laws will go far enough?
Well, without seeing a draft of how he intends to apply the measures, and more importantly, how he intends to enforce, who is supposed to enforce these measures? I mean, what statutory independent body is going to oversee?
Aren't the department looking for submissions from bodies to do this, including, I think it was the Broadcasting Authority of Ireland, or among many who've applied?
Well, it'll be interesting to see if an entity such as the BAI is set up to independently police this. I mean, if you take something like cyberbullying, that effectively is a big data problem. The sheer volume and velocity of content. Our Gardaí are already struggling, significantly under-resourced. So if you're going to create a law and it has the volume that these sort of crimes have the potential to generate, then how are we going to enforce it?
Mary, thanks very much for speaking to us again this morning. That's Dr. Mary Aiken, who's a cyber psychologist. She's also honorary professor at the Department of Law and Criminology at the University of East London.
Police in the Netherlands have arrested a man after discovering six people, thought to be members of the same family, locked away in a secret room at an isolated farmhouse in the north of the country. The six, five siblings and a bedridden man said to be their father, had no contact with the outside world for almost a decade. According to local news reports, the family had been waiting for the end of time. Netherlands-based reporter Stephanie van der Berg has been telling me how the family's apparent incarceration was uncovered.
Well, it turns out that the eldest son in the family, a 25-year-old man, left the family house and went to a nearby bar and explained that that he had difficult situations at home. He didn't want to stay there and stuff was going on. And then the concerned people at the bar, because he showed up looking very disheveled and kind of dirty and thin, called the police because they didn't really know what to do with the situation. And the police came with him and interviewed him and went to look at the farm where he lived, and all of a sudden found this family in a kind of hidden compartment in the farm.
And the area that the farm was located, can you describe it to us?
It's very rural in the north of the Netherlands, where it doesn't have a lot of, there are neighbors, but they're far away. So the farm is located a bit off the road, completely surrounded by trees. So you can't really see inside. So there were neighbors, but they couldn't really see inside. And they said there was one man that they always saw on the property that would also leave the property and come and go. But never saw anybody else in that house. So they never saw the whole family, and they didn't know that there was an entire family on that property.
The man who turned up in the bar was described, I think you said, as pretty disheveled, looked like he'd lost a lot of weight. Do we know anything about the condition of the other members of the family? If they are a family, is it clear at this stage that they're actually related?
What police says is they say they are a family and they still are investigating. So it's not quite sure they're related, but they say they are. So that is something that remains to be investigated by the authorities. And the state of the family was, it seems that all the siblings were, and really give a lot of medical information apart from that, they were kind of surprised at seeing all the new things in the bar, for example, the eldest sibling, and the father of the family had a stroke and was bedridden.
As far as we know, what they say is that they were isolated, locked away in this room for the best part of a decade, for the last 9 years.
Yes, it turns out yesterday, late evening, it turns out that some Dutch media found a Facebook profile for somebody who's believed to be the eldest son. And although he had put some pictures up recently, he had a silence of 9 years on the Facebook account. And this is also what he told people in the bar, that when he first came there, that he hadn't been outside in 9 years because he wasn't allowed that by his family. And apparently the patrons of the bar were asking him, you know, why is it so difficult at home? What is going on? And apparently he told them that his family was deeply religious.
Now, the reports that a man has been arrested, detained by police, is that right? But it's...
Yes.
Do we know anything about that?
Yes, he is identified as a 58-year-old man, and some media reports that he is an Austrian by origin, and working as a handyman in the neighborhood, in neighboring towns. And he is not related to the family, apparently, and he is the person that the oldest son indicated sometimes did groceries for them, and neighbors say that that's the man they saw, and that's the man who would come to this farm with a lot of building material and things like that. He was the man driving up and down the property.
And what about the mother in this family, Stephanie? What's known about her? Is there any information about her?
The mayor of the town where they were found gave a press conference yesterday and explained that as far as the authorities know, the mother died before this family moved into this property, which they're believed to have moved in 2010.
And the reaction in the locality to this, people just must be astonished.
Yeah, there's just bewilderment. They say, well, they knew that there was something strange, or they thought that there might be something strange going on, but that an entire family was kind of hiding there or being kept there, that is astonishing to them. And what they say is they saw police come to the farm over the years, but they never got past the gate. And when they were asked, why didn't you report this when you thought strange things were going on, they said, but we saw the police coming up to the gate and talking to the man who rented the property, the man who was later arrested. And they never kind of pushed through. So we figured that they'd checked it out and it was all right.
And that was reporter Stephanie van der Berg speaking to us about that extraordinary case in the Northern Netherlands. Brian is with us with this morning's business news. Brian.
Thank you, Brian. The pound is sitting at five-month highs as negotiations on a Brexit deal are deemed to be moving in the right direction, with the differences between the sides narrowing. Aidan Donnelly, head of equities with Davy, is on the line. The pound is highly reactive at the moment, Aidan. Big swings depending on mainly on rumour and leaks, and there's probably a bit of volatility to go yet.
Oh, I would have thought so, yes. Literally with each news story that comes out, the pound is reacting, and it's also feeding through to a lot of the equity markets and stocks that would be deemed to have been negatively impacted by a hard Brexit are rallying on the news of a potential deal, and we've seen it in some of the Irish stocks as well as a lot of the UK stocks.
And the stock market is an interesting barometer here, because some stocks actually go up because the pound is going down. Isn't that the case?
That is the case, absolutely. You know, stocks that would be very domestically focused within the UK have suffered over the last kind of 2 years, whereas the stocks that are much more globally orientated have, with the weakness in sterling, been very strong performers, particularly those in the FTSE 100.
Cast your eye a little further west now, Aidan. It's earnings season in the US. It's considered quite an important one because it comes against the backdrop of elevated stock markets and signs of a global economy that's slowing down, and that's creeping into the US economy now. It's a few days in now. What have we seen so far?
It certainly is a key earnings season. We've seen a couple of the banks report yesterday. The big banks like the JP Morgan and Goldman reported yesterday. We have more of those today. But I think, you know, we've seen a deterioration in the forecasts for a lot of the companies in the S&P 500. Really, as you said, on the back of the stronger dollar, but also more importantly, the tariffs and the trade. So I think what will be key for people to watch is and listen to is what companies are saying about their guidance for the rest of this year and into next year, particularly if no end is in sight for the trade negotiations.
And the trade war is having an impact. We heard that warning from the IMF yesterday. They believe that it could knock a full percent off the expected growth otherwise if there had been no trade war.
Absolutely. Like, if you look at it at a company level, at the end of June, analysts were probably forecasting slightly flat profit year on year for the third quarter. We're now down at nearly negative 5%. So there has been a deterioration as the real bite has come from the tariffs being implemented over the last 3 months.
Looking ahead over the next few days, there'll be a lot of interest in the so-called FANG stocks, the big tech stocks, and Netflix kicks off this evening. Its stock has been under pressure over the last while. What are we expecting to hear from them?
Well, it's interesting for the tech sector in general. The earnings forecasts have been coming down quite a bit over the last 3 months, and they're probably seeing some of the largest declines. And I think what will be very, very important is, given how strong the stocks have been over the last kind of 18 months, months to 2 years, people will be looking to see, are the earnings growth coming through? And in case of Netflix, you know, are we seeing good subscriber growth, or is the price increases that they've put through over the last kind of 9 to 12 months beginning to bite in terms of consumer engagement?
And the fact that stocks have been growing so strongly over the last 2 years or so, they're almost defying gravity in some sense, and there have been predictions of the end of the bull run. Are we there yet? Is this the end of the road?
No, I don't think so. I think, you know, so long as we can still see earnings growth coming through, just definitely valuations have expanded over the, particularly over this year. So, you know, I think there's probably not a lot of room for further multiple expansion from here. But I think, you know, so long as the economies remain okay, and certainly into next year, you're likely to still see some economic growth in the U.S., even against the backdrop of the trade issues. And I think wider global growth is going to be, albeit at lower levels than where we were in the last few years, still growing. And I think against that backdrop, companies can continue to grow their profitability, and that should give the last kind of push up in equity markets from here.
Aidan Donnelly, Head of Equities with Davy, thank you very much indeed. More business news at 8:30. Now it's back to Gavin.
Let's get a weather forecast. Jerry Murphy's at Met Aaron. Morning, Jerry.
Thank you very much indeed, Gavin, and a very good morning from Met Aaron. Well, as we go through the rest of the week, our weather will be fairly unsettled as low pressure continues to dominate. Now, indeed, for many areas, today will be the best of the coming days with good sunshine and just well-scattered showers. However, for Thursday, Friday and the weekend, there'll be plenty of heavy showers or longer spells of rain with the risk of thunder and hail at times. At the moment, though, it's a fine, bright morning across the country with good sunshine. However, there are some scattered showers in the west. And during the day, these showers will extend further eastwards, mainly affecting the western half of the country, but there'll be decent dry spells in between, and eastern coastal counties will stay largely dry. Highest temperatures today of 11 to 14 degrees with moderate southwest winds, and these winds will tend to strengthen on the west coast towards evening. Then tonight will become quite blustery as the south to southwest winds continue to strengthen, especially on south and west coasts. Many areas will be mainly dry. However, later tonight, heavy showers will develop in western and southern coastal counties with temperatures of 4 to 8 degrees. And then tomorrow, Thursday, will be a blustery and very showery day, with the showers becoming widespread during the morning and then continuing for the rest of the day. And some of these showers will merge to longer spells of rain tomorrow with the risk of thunder and hail. Highest temperatures once again of 11 to 14 degrees with fresh gusty southerly winds. And there'll be little change on Friday. The low pressure will continue to dominate. The showers will be widespread and heavy with possible longer spells of rain and a continuing risk of hail and thunder. Over the weekend, though, there will be more in the way of brighter spells. Saturday will be cool with bright spells and further heavy showers. And Sunday will see still some showers in the east, but it will tend to be drier in the west. So overall, a showery picture in store for the rest of the week. But for today, good bright sunshine and some scattered showers, which will be mainly in the west. That's the forecast. Good morning.
It's 8 o'clock. Good morning again on Wednesday, the 16th of October. This is Morning Ireland on RTE Radio 1 with Brian Dobson and Gavin Jennings. The news is read by Brian Jennings.
EU and UK negotiators are resuming their discussions in Brussels to try to secure a revised withdrawal agreement before an effective deadline of 10 o'clock this morning. Talks adjourned after midnight with no breakthrough. Our Europe editor Tony Connolly.
Yesterday, optimism about a potential breakthrough steadily rose as both sides seemed to be narrowing the gap on customs, the role of Stormont, and what legal guarantees and controls might be needed. The European Commission has pushed for the UK to move back towards the original Northern Ireland-only backstop, meaning Northern Ireland staying in the EU's customs union and single market, while London has insisted on a dual customs arrangement, with Northern Ireland staying in the UK's customs territory but operating under EU customs and tariffs rules. rules. Bridging that gap has been the main task, but the issue of consent and VAT are also proving to be challenging. Michel Barnier will brief the College of 27 Commissioners later this morning and then will tell Member States at 2 p.m. local time what deal has been reached, if any. The EU has insisted that negotiations per se cannot happen at tomorrow's summit of EU leaders. Tony Connolly, RTE News, Brussels.
The body that scrutinises public spending in the UK has warned of significant risks to the operation of checks at the Irish border in the event of a disorderly Brexit. In a report, the UK's National Audit Office said that mitigating these risks was now, to some extent, out of the British government's control. The report follows an examination by the Audit Office of preparations that the British government has been making since the Brexit deadline was extended to the 31st of October. The public spending watchdog also says that the necessary infrastructure and staff are not in place to carry out checks on the approach to Dover and Eurotunnel at Folkestone. The chairman of the US House of Representatives Ways and Means Committee has issued a fresh warning that there will be no trade deal between the US and the UK if Brexit leads to the return of a hard border. Congressman Richard Neal was speaking at an event at the Irish Embassy in Washington last night. The committee has jurisdiction over all US taxation and tariffs. Our Washington correspondent, Brian O'Donovan.
The US House Ways and Means Committee will oversee any future trade deal between the US and the UK after Brexit, and last night its chairman, Congressman Richard Neal, reiterated his warning that there will be no deal if the Good Friday Agreement is undermined. It's a position that's been backed by the Speaker of the House, Nancy Pelosi, something which was highlighted by Congressman Neal last night. He told an audience at the Irish Embassy in Washington that they are happy to do a trade agreement with the UK, but the border must be kept open and left alone. On the issue of Ireland getting access to E3 visas, Richard Neal said this is something that can be revisited. The measure was blocked by one Republican senator who put a hold on the bill, something which Congressman Neal described as anti-democratic. Brian O'Donovan, RTE News, Washington.
The chief executive of Hong Kong, Carrie Lam, has had to abandon delivering her annual policy speech in the territory's legislature because of heckling by opposition politicians. The demonstration was staged following months of pro-democracy protests on the streets of Hong Kong. Mrs. Lam later delivered her policy address via web link. The US House of Representatives has passed a bill that aims to defend civil rights in Hong Kong. The Hong Kong Human Rights and Democracy Act will now move to a similar vote in the Senate. The legislation would end Hong Kong's special trading status with the United States unless the State Department certified annually that city authorities were respecting human rights and the rule of law. The US Vice President Mike Pence and the US Secretary of State Mike Pompeo are travelling to the Turkish capital Ankara today to press the government there to halt its offensive against Syrian Kurdish fighters. Mr. Pence is due to meet the Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan tomorrow. Turkish media is reporting that President Erdogan has told the US President Donald Trump that Turkey will never declare a ceasefire in northeastern Syria and that he was not worried about US sanctions. Now the time is coming up to 6 minutes past eight.
RTE Radio 1 weather with ESB Networks. Working on a construction site? Stay clear of overhead wires and underground cables. For emergencies, call 1850 372 999.
It'll be generally dry with sunshine this morning. Scattered showers in the west will extend eastwards today, affecting the western half of the country, with eastern coastal counties staying dry. Highest temperatures will range from 11 to 15 degrees. And there's a warning that south to southwest winds will occasionally reach gale force tonight on coasts from Valentia to Slinehead to Bloody Foreland.
Insurance rip-offs, insurance scams, Brexit, and a warning from Gardaí about how homeowners who don't have a security code on their Wi-Fi are facilitating the downloading of pornography. Those are some of the stories on your front pages this morning. The Irish Times, Irish Daily Mirror and Belfast Telegraph all lead with the Brexit talks, which continued through the night. The Times and Mirror strike an optimistic note with the headlines, prospects of Brexit deal at summit improve and on the brink of a deal. The Telegraph, meanwhile, quotes DUP leader Arlene Foster, saying last night that gaps remained on a deal that her party could support. Foster, work still required for a deal on Brexit, is the headline there. The Irish Independent leads with the line that the central bank is to launch a probe into the practice of dual pricing, which is when insurers target clients, often older customers, who are unlikely to challenge their renewal quotes. The Irish Daily Mail, meanwhile, leads with the arrest of three generations of the one family from West Dublin who are alleged to have lodged up to 60 fraudulent insurance claims. And that story is also carried inside most of today's other papers. The Irish Sun and Herald both lead today with the questioning of two men in relation to the fatal stabbing of 31-year-old Derek Redden in Loughlinstown in Dublin in the early hours of yesterday morning. For its lead story, the Irish Examiner quotes Cope Foundation Chief Executive Sean Abbott saying that the charity needs €34 million extra per year to meet its obligation to the children and adults with intellectual disabilities and autism who avail of its services. The Irish News leads today with the line that families of the 10 Protestant workmen who were murdered at King's Mill in South Armagh in 1976, along with the sole survivor Alan Black, have called for the inquest into the IRA atrocity, which has been running for more than 5 years, to be brought to an end. The Irish Daily Star leads with the Garda investigation into a rape allegation. Homeowners in Cork are being warned that perpetrators are parking outside homes where there is no Wi-Fi security code to download pornographic images. That's a lead story in today's Echo, which reports that there has been an increase in the number of pornography investigations in Cork City in recent years. The Independent runs with the front page picture today of Amy Dunn, the woman who, as a teenager, became known as Miss D during her High Court fight 12 years ago to travel for an abortion. She talks to Tanya Sweeney in today's paper about the impact that case had on her life. Elsewhere this morning, climate change, the most serious issue for the majority of voters. That's a headline on the front of today's Times, generated by the findings of its latest Ipsos MRBI poll. And that paper also carries a story on its front page on the family of seven found hidden in a cellar in the Netherlands, which said that they were waiting for the end of time. And the Examiner reports on a new study on the increase in rugby injuries amongst Irish women. We're told that there was a fivefold increase in concussions over a 10-year period. A number of today's papers report on a company called Spaceborne Unlimited, which believes that within 12 years, women will be able to give birth in space. A number of papers carry coverage today on the launch of Kathleen Watkins' new collection of her favourite poems. And the Independent reports on a new book chronicling 40 years of the Dublin Marathon by Sunday World sports journalist Sean McGoldrick. And finally, another marathon man, former soldier Mark Conlon, who famously ran 33 marathons in as many days, now intends to run two full marathons in the one day later this month in an aid of St. Vincent de Paul. The 36-year-old says that this will be his toughest challenge yet, since he'll be running through the night to complete his first marathon around Clontarf and Howth before taking part in this year's Dublin City Marathon the following morning.
Brexit. There are reports of optimism this morning. The value of the pound is rising, so are UK and EU negotiators close to reaching agreement that could see a Brexit in 15 days that doesn't require border checks on this island? Will any agreement pass through the House of Commons? Will the people or the politicians of the North be asked to decide? Talks continued into the early hours in Brussels and will resume shortly. In London, the British Prime Minister met late with the DUP leader and deputy leader, and in Belfast, their Northern Secretary met with the Foreign Minister here. The main stumbling blocks continue to be how to manage customs on the island of Ireland and what role Stormont might have in endorsing any new agreement. Speaking on BBC Newsnight last night, the former Conservative Party Chief Whip MP Mark Harper said the Prime Minister is very aware of how much he needs the DUP and leader Arlene Foster on side.
The reason why the Prime Minister's been spending a lot of time with the DUP and why she didn't say no to the proposals, what she said was their gaps remain
if
in
she
the
could
negotiation.
Support, if she could support a partnership arrangement where Northern Ireland was in the UK customs territory but adhering to EU rules around tariffs, she said no.
She made it clear that wouldn't be acceptable, and she said gaps remain, and that's why the negotiations are still ongoing. But they're very important because I think if we don't have the DUP on board and we don't have some of my Conservative colleagues, the deal isn't going to get through Parliament. And I think the Prime Minister is very well aware of that.
That's Conservative MP Mark Harper speaking to BBC's Newsnight last night. We heard from Brussels and Belfast earlier. Let's cross to London now and our correspondent Sean Whelan. Morning, Sean.
Morning.
A variety of noises from the people Boris Johnson will depend upon if he's going to finally win a vote in the House of Commons. What do they sound like this morning?
They sound like a cacophony of voices. The same problem that he's had basically ever since he became Prime Minister, and that is that he doesn't really command any kind of majority in the House. In fact, not even really command it. He's got this parliamentary minority, a minus 45. So effectively, it's government in name only. Gino in this country. We've heard a lot about Brino, Brexit in name only. Well, there you go. Gino is a new acronym at the moment. He has to put together a coalition, essentially, to carry Brexit through the House of Commons. And that means not just dealing with factions within his own party, not just having the DUP on board, but also crossing the aisle to opposition parties. So if you like, I can try and briefly give you a canter through the arithmetic on this one, because he's got to deal with 25 yes. hardline opponents of the previous withdrawal agreement that Theresa May had negotiated. These are the people who voted all three times against that agreement. You've got the 22 Tory rebels. These are people who got booted out by Boris Johnson for opposing a no-deal option. So these are a group who absolutely oppose the concept of Britain leaving the European Union without a deal. Then you've got the DUP, who have positioned themselves in a pretty pivotal way because the last, hardest, most difficult issue to deal with in those talks in Brussels is the Ireland, Northern Ireland border issue. They are seen as pretty critical, because if they go against the government, they are likely to drag some of those, at least some of those 25 hardline opponents of the withdrawal agreement into their camp. Now, that group has been diligently worked on by the Prime Minister and his whips. They seem fairly confident that they will get most of that 25 onto their side, but still, there was another meeting last night with the so-called Spartans group, people like Ian Duncan Smith and Mark Francois. They are going to take a fair bit of convincing. The leader of the European Research Group, Stephen Baker, he's more emollient in his dealings with the Prime Minister, suggesting that they might well be able to back the deal. So it looks like that group is split, that the very, very hardline opponents are a minority of it, but still the DUP's position could be critical in getting those numbers through. Then we come to opposition parties. The Labour Party, the government whips have been dealing with about 40 Labour MPs who they think might be tempted to come across. They think there's about 17 look likely to cross the floor and support a Boris Johnson negotiated withdrawal agreement. Then you've got the Liberal Democrats. They're completely opposed to Brexit, and they are looking to have a second referendum. They're going to be putting down a motion today to see if it gets selected by Speaker Bercow. If it does, they want to have an amendment to the Queen's Speech voted on Monday that would provide for a second referendum here in Britain. And then, of course, there's the wider Labour Party and its strategy of trying to get a general election, negotiate its own Labour version of Brexit,
okay,
then put that to a referendum of the people.
As you were reporting there, Steve Baker, the chairman of the European Research Group, some of the quotes after he had met, had meetings in Downing Street last night, was that he said he felt optimistic that a tolerable deal might be reached. And as Tommy Gorman was telling us earlier, the meeting between Arlene Foster, Nigel Dodds and Boris Johnson at Downing Street, where the FT were reporting this morning about a possible pay packet in the event of a deal being reached. Given that any deal is unlikely to be very different from the Northern Ireland only backstop, the original deal that Theresa May tried to get her party to agree to, what is it, Sean, that will convince those within Boris Johnson's party to support him? Is it going to be politics, or is it going to be the detail of the deal?
I think it's going to be the politics of the deal foremost, because there seems to be a growing sense that this might be their last shot at actually getting a negotiated agreement to leave the European Union. Remember, they could have left the EU at any stage over the past 6 months if they thought that walking out without a deal was a good idea. So it could have been done. But presumably it wasn't done because most people think it's not a good idea to leave the European Union without an agreement and do it in a disorderly fashion because of the disruption, particularly in terms of economic disruption, that would bring about. So they want a deal. They want to get an agreement with the EU and leave in an orderly fashion. And this is probably their best chance of doing that. The other reason is that Boris Johnson is a leaver. He was one of the leading figures in the Leave campaign, and that probably convinces enough of the hardline leavers and people who are opposing Theresa May's deal that, look, we can probably trust Boris Johnson on this in ways that we probably didn't feel comfortable in trusting Theresa May. I think all of these different factions that we've outlined are probably going to have to hold their nose and vote for a deal that they will quibble about various aspects of. But essentially, if they want to get out of the European Union in an orderly fashion and in a way that they can see clearly what is going to happen once they leave, then this is probably the time to do it. And it's probably not the time to be holding out for yet more and more and more concessions, because they know that on the other side, patience is wearing thin as well.
Sean, thank you. That's our London correspondent, Sean Whelan. 21 minutes past 8. 8.31, Brian Finn is here with more business news. Morning again, Brian.
Thanks, Gavin. Good morning. VAT of 13.5% is to be introduced on certain food supplements as part of the finance bill, which Pascal Donoghue has confirmed will be published tomorrow. Some products, including foods for specific groups and supplements such as folic acid, will continue to attract a zero tax rate. VAT of 23% on food supplements had been scheduled to come in from March, but that measure was postponed following widespread opposition to the move. Netflix is among the companies that are due to report third quarter results in the US today. It's the first of the big tech stocks to report this earnings season. The stock has been under pressure of late, having missed expectations for subscriber growth last quarter. Earnings are being closely watched as they come against the backdrop of signs of a slowdown in the US and global economies. The pound has lost a bit of ground in early trade, but remains at a five-month high against the euro and dollar amid optimism about the prospects of a Brexit deal. The euro is trading right now at 86.7 pence sterling and $1.105.
Let's talk to Fine Gael MEP and Vice President of the European Parliament, Mairead McGuinness, is on the line now. Very good morning, Mairead McGuinness.
Good morning.
Thanks for talking to us this morning. The lights were burning late last night in Brussels. What are you hearing?
Well, you're right, the lights were burning late, but they didn't burn through the night. And I suppose my interpretation on that is that work had been, you know, going well and progress was being made, but not enough for the negotiators to plough through the night. So I think what we're hearing is probably what's been reflected in your news bulletin thus far, that certainly the momentum has really been fired up since the meeting on Friday between the two leaders, and that the negotiators were literally told to get down and get a deal done. Now, we've sort of, in the Parliament here, we've been through ups and downs on the Brexit road for the last 3 years. So while there's a sense of hope and perhaps expectation, we're also being realistic in that at the final hour, things can go wrong. So we're not saying that it will be over the line. But there does seem to be a pressure from the UK side to get something done in time for the leaders to at least look at it and give it some approval. And then you're into another process of ratification. But let's not jump our fences. We still have not got a deal. We know that there is progress towards a deal and that there are meetings happening in the UK to try and, you know, around the DUP's position. And it does, I suppose, point towards what many of us thought mightn't happen this week, but it does point towards perhaps something breaking by lunchtime today. But, you know, I wouldn't put money on it, but right. I certainly sense in the air a more, I suppose, optimistic view that things might get done.
Right. But given the fact that the negotiations actually have been taking place really in this intensive period only a matter of days, and that's obviously a very short period in which to start from scratch with a legal text, and that I think everybody understands is essential. Is the likelihood now that if something does emerge, it'll be a version or something close to that Northern Ireland only backstop of 2 years ago?
Well, look, that you would perhaps predict that, but none of us know. We know that the two issues that needed sorting was the customs issue and also the consent issue. And I've heard more about the customs than consent, but perhaps that is why they were late last night. Mm. And you're right, you would imagine that it has to move closer to that because it is the cleanest, most effective and efficient way. If it goes that direction, how will that be perceived in the UK? I did see some tweets this morning suggesting that the Tory party is not as united as the Prime Minister might like in the direction he's travelling. But until we see the detail, none of us are in a position to say what's in the withdrawal agreement. But certainly from a European Union side, we want something that is legally sound and can work, not just in the short term, but certainly for the longer term. And the UK has its own objectives. But as I read it, the British Prime Minister, where earlier we might have thought he wanted a no deal, but it seems now he's very determined to get a deal. He wants it done this week. I think he also quite likes the idea of burning the midnight oil and things being done at the last minute. That's his view and perception of how Europe works. When he was a journalist, that's how he saw it. So maybe this is his personal approach to the negotiations. He has a sitting of the House of Commons on Saturday, which would suggest that he's expecting something to talk about on Saturday. And therefore, he will want that his timetable is not disrupted. And if he wants that more than anything else, then he is going to have to give ground on some of the key issues. And really, Europe is not doing anything other than protecting the Good Friday Agreement, protecting its own interests in these negotiations. And I'm sure the Prime Minister of the United Kingdom has his own objectives here. Just, but it seems to me he likes the idea of getting this done, as he's been saying so frequently, get Brexit done. Yeah. My view is we need to get the right Brexit done and we cannot rush it just for the sake of meetings.
That's exactly what I wanted to pick up on you. Maybe just briefly, if you can. The London Times is reporting today that Johnson is fighting attempts by the EU to delay Brexit until next year. Is there any appetite there to postpone yet again Britain's departure?
Well, I think there's a lot of frustration, I'd say, amongst member states and certainly in the European Parliament. But we've been, you know, patient thus far. And if it took an extra few weeks, I don't think anyone would say, no, we're not going to give that extra time. But to suggest that we're trying to frustrate the process or trying to hold the UK inside or push the timelines out is not the case at all. If anything, because we have a new Parliament, a new Commission, there is an urgency at the EU side that this Brexit would get done, but there's also a very real sense that we have to make sure we do it right, and that's why you need to give it time. But to suggest that Europe is trying to, you know, push the deadline beyond the end of October, the January deadline is a suggestion. This is not a European issue. In a sense, we have to do what is right for the negotiations, and indeed the UK would have to request an extension. Right. It wouldn't be imposed by the European Union.
More on this, no doubt, in the hours ahead, but for the moment, thank you very much indeed. That's Mairead McGuinness, Vice President of the European Parliament. If you have an iPhone, an iPad or any Apple device, you may have noticed some changes in how your gadget operates. The iOS 13 brought a range of new features. However, it's also apparently introduced a number of disruptive bugs. The iOS 13 has been updated twice since its installation in September, with the first attempt at rectifying the problems only 2 days after the original update. Will Goodbody, our business editor, can tell us more about this. So, Will, what's the problem?
Well, Brian, as you say, once or twice a year, Apple releases a major update to its iOS mobile operating system. And it's usually a positive development for Apple mobile device users, bringing with it a plethora of latest features, but not always. And sometimes, the updates bring with them a host of serious, unanticipated issues that cause huge frustration for users. Last month saw the introduction of iOS 13, the latest update, which promised a new feature or new features like a new dark look called dark mode and a new camera interface, photo and video editing tools, that kind of thing. But it was features that weren't planned or expected that may have been causing trouble for Apple users ever since. Since September, social media and Apple online support forums have been flooded with messages from frustrated customers who've been struggling with a number of bugs. And even the US Department of Defense urged employees not to update their iPhones to the early iOS 13 version a few weeks ago. So what kind of issues are we talking about? Well, there are many, I suppose, principally around calls. There's been issues with dropping of calls within a minute or two of them being placed. Also, the phone not ringing when a call is coming through. There have been battery drain issues reported too. Now, to be fair, that's often caused by the reindexation of operating system files and app updates after a major operating system update like this. There's also been some reports of overheating as well.
a range of issues with the Mail app, and the list goes on. So quite serious in some cases and quite frustrating for users.
And the remedies that have been offered by Apple?
Well, I suppose Apple hasn't said a whole lot on this. I mean, I contacted them about it last night to see what their official position was, and I've heard nothing back since. But this is a sort of part of a natural process of releasing new software, no matter how much engineering and beta testing goes on. Unfortunately, there will always be some flaws that get through. But in this case, reports suggest that Apple has been forced to rush the release of some of the later iOS 13 updates following a number of critical security issues that emerged recently. In particular, a pretty serious security flaw was found by Google's security researchers and reported to Apple. This was quickly patched by iOS 13.1, which was meant to fix many of the other vulnerabilities also, but so quickly, in fact, that it seems that the changes introduced a host of other issues and bugs along the way. And that's often the issue with these types of updates, that when a new version is released, users then complain about bugs, and in the process of trying to rapidly fix those bugs, the developers then create more problems. So far, there's actually been four versions of iOS 13 released in just 4 weeks, including the latest one just last night, and that's a pretty large number in such a scenario.
All right, well, we leave it there. Thanks very much indeed for that. Our business editor, Will Goodbody, there. The time now just 8:30. As the Brexit negotiations resume in Brussels this morning, the chairman of the United States House of Representatives Ways and Means Committee has issued a fresh warning that there'll be no trade deal between the US and the UK if Brexit leads to a return of the hard border on the island of Ireland. Congressman Richard Neal was speaking to our Washington correspondent, Brian O'Donovan, at an event at the Irish Embassy in Washington last night on the issue of future US-Irish relations.
Chairman Neal, I suppose the theme of tonight's talk was the future of US-Irish relations in a changing world. How do you assess that future when we look at tariffs, when we look at concerns over post-Brexit trade deals? What does the future have in store?
Well, I think the links certainly loom quite large, whether it be in economics or certainly the emotional issues, and recalling how important immigration was to the United States. And I think that the opportunities to continue to grow and strengthen the relationship are going to remain paramount for all of us. It is remarkable that a small island, 6 million people north and south, can command the presence that they do here on Capitol Hill in Washington. I think, with the exception maybe of only one other country, that the relationship between America and Ireland is as strong as it's ever been.
As chairman of the House Ways and Means Committee, you're in charge of trade deals. You have repeatedly warned there'll be no trade deal in a post-Brexit scenario if it meant a return to a hard border. Speaker Pelosi has given same warnings. But what would you say to those who would say that Donald Trump, if he wants to do a trade deal, he's just going to go and do one?
Well, the Constitution is very clear in the responsibilities that it delineates. And the Ways and Means Committee is responsible for trade and tariff issues. Tariffs, after all, are a tax, and the Ways and Means Committee has responsibility for tariffs. All revenue measures have to originate in the House of Representatives, and within the House, it is the Ways and Means Committee. So I think that we're in very good form on constitutional grounds, but just as importantly, in terms of the international success of the Good Friday Agreement, we should be heralding the triumph which ended the longest standing political dispute in the history of the Western world.
Are you monitoring developments right now with regards to Brexit? There looks to be maybe some chink of light, maybe some kind of a deal.
We're monitoring it daily, and we are going to hear from members of the Irish government again tomorrow. And I think that the follow-up is going to have a profound interest, largely because it looks as though there's been some progress between Ireland and the UK. But, you know, the other really good thing about this is there's now parity in the relationship. And the voice of, I think, the Irish government here in America as it relates to the success of the Good Friday Agreement has been unwavering. And we're all very grateful for that.
But on the Good Friday Agreement and on a trade deal, your warning remains the same.
I have no reason to back away from the emphasis I've placed upon the fact that America is a guarantor of the Good Friday Agreement. The Good Friday Agreement said clearly that Strand 2, Belfast, Dublin, was going to be the most important part of that agreement. And what's extraordinary is how well it's worked. There's no talk about going back to the bad old days. Instead, without that border, commerce has flourished, cultural exchanges have taken place, and consultation in the governance every day in the North has been very, very important to the Republic.
You met with your Democratic colleagues tonight in terms of the whole impeachment question. Speaker Pelosi saying there will be no impeachment vote anytime soon. Why not?
Well, we had a meeting with the Speaker at earlier about 5 o'clock. There were 6 of us that met with her. And she is still exploring opinion on this. I think it's very clear constitutionally that you don't have to have a vote in the House of Representatives. But I also think that, recall, when you're in the leadership of the House of Representatives, you constantly are required to take the pulse of the membership to see if there's a new direction that has been offered. And later on, when the entire Democratic caucus met, I think that there were some pretty assertive opinions that were offered on both sides of the argument. So I think that the Speaker is still in the position of seeking consultation.
Do you inevitably see there will be an impeachment vote?
I think it's hard to say at this point. I think that we need to continue to follow the facts. I think that the pace of the investigation, as it has come from the Intelligence Committee, is certainly moving forward at a very, in a very assertive manner.
Just finally, to return to an Irish issue, you were centrally involved in the E3 visa issue last year. It didn't get over the line. Are you confident that it's something that can be revisited and maybe E3 visas could be made available to Ireland?
It can be revisited, and I think that the Irish government deserves great credit here at the embassy in particular for the sponsorship and advocacy that they offered, and it did pass the House of Representatives unanimously. And I think that if there were simply a vote in the United States Senate, it would pass there as well. But it's being held up by one member of the Senate using what is known as a hold on a piece of legislation. I think that's frankly anti-democratic. But we've done our work on the ground with various parts of our caucus, and we have Republican support for the bill as well.
U.S. Congressman Richard Neal speaking there to our correspondent Brian O'Donovan in Washington. The time, Morning Ireland.
25 to 9, you're listening to Morning Ireland. John Murray is here with the sports news. Morning, John.
With the bad news, yes, defeat for the Republic of Ireland in Geneva last night. Gavin, in their Group D Euro qualifier, Switzerland were the 2-0 winners. It means we have to beat Denmark at the Aviva on November 18th to qualify for Euro 2020. Of course, there is that backdoor Nations League route, but it's as clear as the mud in Stade Geneva last night at the moment. For the record, Seferovic put the Swiss ahead after 16 minutes and Shane Duffy's own goal in added time sealed the home side's 2-0 win. Darren Randolph had kept Ireland in it by saving a Rodriguez spot kick on 75 minutes. Seamus Coleman handling the ball in the penalty area and being sent off for picking up his second yellow card on the night. He now misses the final qualifier against Denmark. In a moment, we'll be getting the thoughts of former Republic of Ireland striker Stephen Elliott. But first, midfielder Alan Brown had this take on last night's performance.
Yeah, it was difficult, you know, it was always going to be. Conditions were obviously not great for both sides, and we knew that it was going to be a tough test tonight, and it proved to be that. But I think we've shown a lot of positives, certainly in the second half, and hopefully we can take that into next month's game now.
They're a good side as well, they moved the ball really quickly.
Yeah, they are, and I think we probably showed them too much respect to begin with. You know, we sat off them, and we were a bit camped in second half. I think it was there for everyone to see that we came out and got up against them. We gave it a good go, and you know, if we get one chance, nick one chance, it turns the game around. But it wasn't to be. But as I said, we've got to take every positive we can from it.
We changed systems a couple of times. Do you think the three centre halves and the wing backs suited us?
Well, it certainly didn't look that tonight, but. You know, it can vary from game to game. You know, it might have came off, and unfortunately tonight it didn't, and we reverted back to the 4-3-3. And I think that certainly looked a lot better when we got up against them and gave it a good go. And yeah, it's not down to the formation. You know, any formation can beat a team. It's how you go out and how you play. And it just wasn't to be tonight.
That's Alan Brown there. We're joined now by Stephen Elliott. Stephen, was it just a simple case of being beaten by a better team?
I think it was always going to be a difficult game. Switzerland, as everybody knows, are a top quality team. We've done well in the Nations League as well. So it's one of them where you're going over there and you're kind of half hoping rather than expecting. And obviously Mick has gone with that formation at the start of the game with the three at the back. And on the evening it didn't quite work. And yeah, they were the better team. You just have to hold your hands up sometimes. But I think second half there was a few positives there. I think Callum O'Dowd came on and he offered us a little bit on the wing. And he's somebody that may come into the reckoning in the Denmark game.
Our passing was very wayward on the night.
Yeah, we did. I just think we never really got a foothold in the game at all. We we kind of, Alan Brown mentioned there, we probably gave them a little bit too much respect. But I think second half, listen, we came out and we kind of put her up to them a little bit better than when we did first half. And to lose the game, obviously went down to 10 men. It was difficult when we were down to 10 men. But we kind of... Going into the Denmark game, I think there's a few positives there. I think obviously Connolly making his debut, it was a tough evening for him as well. But he'll learn from that, and I think Mick will know now that it's one of them where you come to the Aviva last game in the group. If you know we had to win that game to qualify automatically, then definitely you would have took that before the group start, especially with Denmark and Switzerland being in the group.
Can you see us beating Denmark though? The last time they were at the Aviva, they beat us 5-1.
Yeah, that was the last. That was a long time ago, and bar that game, though, we've always had tight games against them. I know they probably had majority of the possession against us when we played them, but that may be the case again. But we can stay in the game, even the game over there. Like we stayed in the game, and we end up getting the equaliser. We can kind of hold them out and stay in the game. You just never know, and I think it's one of them where we have to go in full of confidence. You know, it's a home game against Denmark. I know they're a good team. They're not absolute world beaters, and it's something that we have to kind of win with belief, otherwise we've no chance.
All right, Stephen Elliott, thank you for joining us this morning. In the other Group D game, Georgia beat Gibraltar 3-2. Elsewhere, Spain qualified from Group F thanks to a 1-1 draw with Sweden and Stockholm. David De Gea went off with an apparent hamstring injury, making him a doubt for Sunday's Premier League clash with Liverpool. The Ireland under-21s tasted defeat for the first time in their European qualifiers when they lost to Iceland in Reykjavik. Ireland's Leo Connor was sent off as they were beaten 1-0, but Stephen Kenny's side remained top of Group 1, albeit having played more games than their rivals. Tonight, Piemont take on Shelburne in the second of the Women's FAI Cup semi-finals. The winners play Wexford on November 3rd. In snooker news, Mark Allen has won his first round match at the English Open. Allen overcame James Watana by 4-2 in Crawley. In boxing news, Carl Frampton is set to have his first fight in 11 months when he steps into the ring on the 30th of November. The former world champion has recovered from a hand injury and will take on Tyler McCreary in a super featherweight contest in Las Vegas. In cricket, Ireland were edged out by Scotland by 1 run in their T20 World Cup qualifier warm-up game in Abu Dhabi. The Scots made 210 from their 20 overs, and in response, Ireland with 70 from Andrew Balburnie ended on 209 for 9. There's racing today at Punchestown. The first is off at 2:05. And for more sports news, you can check out the RTE News Now app and RTE.ie.
Dublin Fire Brigade is dealing with a fire at a school off the Malahide Road near Mask Avenue in Coolock in the city. A local resident reported seeing smoke at Scoil Cathrina Coileáine at around 6:10 this morning. The fire is reported to be substantial. 6 fire tenders at the scene, including a specialist unit. One local resident's been taken to hospital as a precaution as a result of smoke inhalation. Residents are being advised to stay indoors and keep their windows closed as firefighters deal with the fire. Let's speak to Rachel Batten. She's a local Fianna Fáil councillor for the area. Rachel, good morning. Thanks for taking our call.
Good morning. Thanks.
You've been down at the school this morning. Tell us about what you saw.
There's a substantial smoke in the area, so it's very difficult to see. There's a number of Dublin Fire Brigades that they've effectively closed off the area to ensure that there's nobody else injured in the fire. Certainly, the fire still seemed to be going on to a certain extent up to an hour ago.
It broke out at around 6:00, as we said, thankfully well before any students were arriving. This is a school of just over 200 girls from 2nd to 6th class, and we understand that all girls, or at least as many girls as is possible, have been alerted that the school is closed for the day. Have you any idea how much damage has been done to the school?
It's very difficult to say how much damage is done because there is quite a bit of smoke. Certainly when I was up there, the smoke was backing on as up as far as St. Brandon's Avenue. It is taking up a lot of the area. Certainly from what's seen, there seems to be a good bit of damage. Now that could be at the back of the school, but it's very difficult to tell at the moment.
Yeah, I've just seen some pictures that Dublin Fire Brigade have put out. We've also retweeted them on our own Morning Ireland Twitter account. And certainly this is one of the shots is an overhead shot, and it does look quite like it's been quite a big fire.
Yes, no, it is a substantial fire, and there are a number of Dublin Fire Brigade units out trying to put it out, and they have cornered off and there is traffic diversions in the area.
What will happen to the children now, do you know, if the school is going to have to be closed for some time? And I presume, looking at the extent of the fire, it will have to be closed for some time.
I think certainly the school will have to. It's definitely closed today. The school have sent out messages to parents that the school is closed today. But I suppose certainly in regards kind of going forward in the next couple of weeks, I think it's probably a little bit early to say certainly if there's anything that can be done with the local schools, etc. We'll work with them trying to come to some arrangement.
Rachel, thanks very much for taking our call. That's Rachel Batten. She's a local Fianna Fáil councillor in Coolock in Dublin, where a fire has broken out at Scoil Cathrina Coilíní, which is now closed today. It's coming up to 9:15. That's the sound of clashes between police and protesters on the streets of Barcelona last night. Fires were started and people attempted to storm regional government offices in the city. It follows the sentencing on Monday of 9 Catalan separatist leaders over their failed bid to break away from Spain 2 years ago. Let's speak to Renata Brito. She's a journalist with Associated Press based in Barcelona. Renata, good morning. Thanks for taking our call.
No problem. Good morning.
Tell me about what you saw.
Well, it escalated very quickly. There was initially a big crowds around the Spanish government delegation in Barcelona, but police had cordoned off the blocks around that government building. So you had crowds on the different streets that led to that building. And on one of those blocks, which consisted mainly of student protesters, things escalated very quickly after protesters began throwing objects onto police, and police responded by pushing them back, using their batons, using foam bullets to disperse the crowds. And that went into the very early hours of the morning. So it was quite chaotic in downtown Barcelona yesterday.
Is it possible to say if the people who are protesting on the streets represent the majority of people in Catalonia?
Absolutely not. There were parallel to this to these clashes, initial demonstrations that were peaceful with people holding candlelights, older people, families on another side of the street. So you have smaller groups of let's say more violent demonstrators, but you also have peaceful demonstrations and gatherings. It would be unfair to generalize this.
Who's organizing the protests?
There are several grassroots groups that are organizing. Last night, it was organized by two very well-known organizations, which were ANC and Omnium, whose leaders are in jail and were convicted on Monday by the Supreme Court. But there is also other groups, and one in particular has caught the attention of the Spanish government. It's called the Democratic Tsunami, and it has been calling for civil disobedience and demonstrations in response to the Supreme Court ruling. They were the ones that called for people to demonstrate at the Barcelona International Airport, which really disrupted the airport on Monday evening and also ended in clashes. So they're now being the target of an investigation, but last night's clashes were not initially organized or called for by them. The government seems to think they are, though, coordinating something and behind this violence.
Renata, thank you very much for speaking to us. That's Renata Brito. She's a journalist with Associated Press in Barcelona. 9:05 now.
The National Library of Ireland will announce details of digital pilots, a pilot scheme to expand the way it collects what it describes as the born digital story of Ireland, allowing content like videos and digital documents to become part of the national collection. The project is a response to the challenge of collecting, preserving and making available Irish digital content, which is growing at an unprecedented rate and which is in danger of being lost. Sandra Collins is director of the National Library of Ireland and she's on the line now. Very good morning to you, Sandra, and thanks for taking the call this morning. I suppose the first thing to ask is, given the vast, huge volume of digital material out there, where do you begin?
Well, that's a good question. And so we're beginning with Marion Keyes. So Marion is an international, a world-known Irish writer and a really, I think, unique modern Irish voice. So Marion has partnered with us over the last year to collect her writer's archive, to collect materials about one of her books and videos about her writing process, about the characters in the book, sample covers for the books, the manuscripts in their digital form with the comments and the editor's corrections and so on. And so that's where we're starting. We thought it was really important to get such a modern, important, visible Irish voice, an Irish writer, a woman writer, something we really want to celebrate and start there.
So in the past, where writers, and perhaps some still do, would print out an early draft of their work and then maybe pick up their pen and start revising it, and those that archive, those documents would be available potentially in the future. A lot of writers do that digitally now, so you're trying to capture that process, if you like.
Yes, exactly. So we're really in our infancy figuring out how to do this. We've been collecting those writers' manuscripts for 140 years. So we're really good at the paper-based material, but this is brand new, and it's new for libraries across the world. So what will this look like? A writer won't bring in an archive boxes full of papers and notebooks, and you'll see little doodles and scrawls in the margin. Instead, it's as likely now to come into us on a memory stick. Maybe it's going to be a PC. Maybe we'll get a transfer of YouTube videos. So that's the challenge, really, both the amount of content and the huge range of things that we want to capture to get that writer's archive.
And how delicate is that material in that format? I mean, we all know that formats, if you're old enough, we can remember formats that have long disappeared, that are no longer in use. So what about preserving these memory sticks or that kind of material for decades, maybe even hundreds of years?
Exactly, Brian. So that is really, really the challenge, because digital formats are much more fragile than paper. We have paper that's decades old and it's absolutely fine. But as you say, you wouldn't trust that you'd be able to access material from your computer in 1995, even if you still had that computer or that content at all. So the digital stuff changes much quicker, and that just makes it much harder. But it's our commitment, this is what the National Library does, is to keep those materials safe forever. So that's why this is a pilot, and it's a big deal for us to announce it today.
All right. Well, we're looking forward to hearing more in the time ahead on that. Sandra Collins, Director of the National Library of Ireland, thanks very much indeed for talking to us. Just coming up to a minute and a half to nine.